what kind of, just from my own perspective, what this year has meant to me to be able to talk with, obviously you and Alan, but, with all the different guests that we kind of managed to have come through, and what this, how this dialogue has sort of improved. Has it improved or has it done the opposite? Just trying to find some meaning or some synthesis of it all. Especially because everyone that I've talked to in this show, I have never met in person, which is kind of weird.
Oh, wow. Well, you should go, you should try and make it to the Sync Cabin this year. We're not sure if we'll be able to make it. We'd like to, but it's quite a feat to go to Idaho. But I'll tell you, it's a fucking good time. You get to meet everybody.
Yeah, so, I imagine it. I mean,
not everybody, but you get to meet some people. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's weird to have a relationship like this without really actual human contact. And I'm just trying to kind of make sense of that. So, because it seems like for me right now, this 1 year of conversations, to be honest, if I was going to speak honestly, to me, it's sort of coming to a close here. That in the 200 plus hours of conversation over this 1 year, for it to go forward another year, 80% of it would be rehash at some point if you really looked at it.
For you, you feel
for
that
me,
80...
For me.
Huh.
The actual like content of the conversation over the next year at a week, at a, you know, once a week kind of interval, that if you were able to stand back, if I was able to stand back, I would feel like there would be a lot of rehash going on, or just not going over the same material again and again with the intent to refine or to make breakthroughs or to expand upon it. But ultimately, in the way conversation works, or at least for me, in my perspective, that we would be going over a lot of stuff. And I don't know. Do you feel that way in any way?
I feel like we definitely do a degree of restating assumptions, but I feel like there's a constant progression. I mean, I feel like I'm always, every week I'm coming up with new things to bring to the table that relate and I'm excited about. So I don't, I don't know if I don't think I resonate with that as much. Also, I don't feel like, I don't know. God, it's a little early in the morning to be processing. I didn't realize it. To look at it like in terms of, in the first place, when you say, oh, we've been doing it for a year, for me, that's cool, but I'm as excited about episode 42 as I am our year marker or something. Like, I don't really see it in terms of like, well, what about this next year? I just see it from week to week and what's going on. It's hard for me to back up and look at it through that lens of in that way. Right now, I mean, I definitely like, I mean, I've had, a degree of, you know, things clicking throughout the week. So, you know, that's just the way it goes for me. I mean, I don't know. I feel like there's certain, it's a consistent thing that I meet with my teacher and I study, and we go over all kinds of, We go over all kinds of interesting factors that I had previously not considered that will just blow my mind. And then I'll take that and see how it corresponds to the things that I've been looking at. And it's interesting that, you know, how regularly I'll find parallels that I can't easily explain. Like synchronicity is a constant unfolding thing. And so it's, I mean, there's, like I said, there's certain assumptions that need restating, especially if someone's going to jump in and see how this all connects, that do get, I guess you could look at them in terms of rehashing, but I don't see it that much as I see it as restating, like kind of the nodes in the network, so to speak. So, I mean, I don't know.
I think for me personally, because I've never had, as a consistent outlet for the exchange of these types of ideas in a conversational way, that it's like, for me, it was sort of like motorcycle maintenance. It's like I took the thing apart completely, and with everyone's help, I put it back together again. And I needed to, like, understand the machine from each individual component and be able to put the thing back together again. And, like, the way I'm feeling about it, it's like now I want to take the motorcycle out on the road. I don't want to sit in the shop and talk about it. And I think that just speaks to my position, my individual position on, I hate the fucking word, but the journey, you know?
That's funny that you'd say that. I just visited my teacher who I traveled to India with for the first time in like 7 years,
wow.
this Tuesday, and just by coincidence there's this girl who somebody brought up there who has dreadlocks, and in my old house that I used to live at, which turned into, well, it was, there's a lot of hippies there, but it turned into more of a stereotypical hippie situation. I went to one party since I moved this community. The whole community got flushed out. New community got flushed in for the most part. But there was this girl, and I'm not sure if she actually lived there or if she was visiting, but whatever. I see her this Tuesday. But way back when I went to a party, she came up to me and she saw that I had a patch that said Brass Tacks, which is a group of people in the city that throw renegades. And she looks at the patch and she goes, "Oh, I have a tribe too." And I was like, "Oh, groovy." And they were literally playing This Is the Dawning of the Age of Aquarius and dancing naked in the living room.
Well, that's beautiful.
It was beautiful, but it was as stereotypical as you could possibly get. Well, this girl shows up at Mount Madonna and she sees Baba Hari Das, and she was like, she didn't know how to relate to, like, it was like this thing, like, and it was cool to watch because she was just like speechless. But she was like, he would ask her a question about her, he asked her about her dreadlocks. And she said, on his board, because he hasn't spoken in 60 years, but he asked about her dreadlocks, and she goes, "Well, it's just this way for now on my journey." And he goes, "Where is your destination?" And she stopped for a really long time, and she goes, "There's no destination." But she was nervous, but it was like, what is the thing? It looked like it was like, what is the thing that the spiritual person is supposed to say to this? And like, he's very casual. Like, he'll go into those things, especially like in class and stuff. It's not as like focused on like being spiritual. It just is who he is. And so it was funny to watch the specifics of referring to it as a journey, because I just had a humorous thing around referring to life as the journey. It's a, "Oh, this is this way on my journey."
It's such a overused cliched term nowadays that anyone can kind of weave it into their discussion about self and spirituality, which actually is, you know, a small victory in itself, but it just drags a lot of baggage, I feel, like when you throw it out there.
She is a good reflection for me, and I appreciated it. She's definitely like in stereotypes in general, when somebody's really playing into a stereotype, sometimes that's a slight trigger and I get a look at my judgment around.
Yeah, exactly. I dig that.
But also, I think that there's something to be said for what you're saying in the first place in relationship to, like, well, if you're on a journey, what is your destination? You know, do you have a destination in mind? Like, either like a general destination or a, like, is that kind of, it sounds like that's like your argument for what you're, in expressing what you're feeling in a way.
Yeah, I think that I want to, what's the song, When I Paint My Masterpiece? Is that Bob Dylan?
What is it?
When I Paint My Masterpiece.
Uh-huh, your magnum opus, yep.
I just want to get an opus, not even the magnum opus. You know, I think I need to start, like, I don't know. I feel like I'm not utilizing this space in the best way anymore. I think it's an amazing space and it's valuable, but I don't think I'm making use of it right now.
Mm. Okay.
So, like, I think, you know, I see the work that you've been putting up. Like that last image you just put up is astounding. How you incorporated the Sergeant Pepper's splicing in the middle. I think it's called When the Lion Roars. Is that the title of it?
Yeah, totally. Thank you. Yeah,
badass. You know, I think at some point I made Always Record my creative space. And I don't think that Always Record is your creative space.
No, it's like my therapy. It's like I don't have to pay for therapy because I can work out some of my thinking here. I feel the same way with my rabbi as well. I feel like I need outlets to both like continue research, depths of research, but then I need outlets in order to kind of organize my thoughts around matters. So, yeah, this is also just like, it feels like a think tank, you know? It's like the things that get spun around here end up getting applied in various ways. And so it's definitely an aid to kind of like organizing the points, I guess you could call them.
You know, I think I also sort of feeling critical of myself because I got lazy, and what I knew I should have been doing this entire year was devoting more time to my understanding of, I think, three specific subject matters, which I think you are obviously just expertly versed in. I think Alan is on a high level versed in them, and I have this sort of fleeting, casual versing in. And it's the three things that I would think of right now, just as far as like, I don't know, scholastic or not intellectual, but my alphabet with the tarot, the Hebrew alphabet, and astrology. I don't have that alphabet in my brain like you clearly have. So you can discuss and converse upon a subject, and you can draw on those alphabets at will, seemingly.
Whatever. I mean, you like all this. You had read this book recently with about John Dee and this whole deal, and like all of that was like super insightful for me. See, I think I mean, you do whatever you want to do. I'm open. I understand. And I will say that I don't know, it's hard sometimes from somebody else's position to see what people are actually getting from what you're bringing to the table. Like, I appreciate what you've been bringing to the table, and it's been very insightful. Although, you know, sometimes when you're in a situation conversationally, and like people are waiting for their turn to talk, which does go on, it doesn't mean that as they're waiting, they're not also listening. You know what I mean?
Like, absolutely.
It's not like all they're doing is sitting there waiting for what they have to chime in with. But if you have something to offer that you're excited to offer, you know, you end up doing that. But it doesn't mean that you're not taking in what others are saying. So I've definitely, like, been appreciating what you bring to the table. The biggest bummer of if, you know, if the show wasn't to go on, to drop a Freudian slip in. Not continuing to get that input and feedback as well. You give great feedback. So, I mean, I don't know. I we could, you know, we've been stretching these shows out for so long. I mean, it doesn't, I'd prefer it be longer than an hour, but it doesn't have to be fucking 4 hours long, you know? Like, if that's part of it, you know, we can do something about that.
I'm needy, David. I'm a needy son of a bitch. but I think one of the handicaps of this environment is that facial recognition or what conversation when you're in the same room with people, it satisfies an element of understanding that goes obviously deeper than just the content, right? Mm-hmm. So it is sort of like talking, it's like speaking to a talking wall. That's, I think, the element that I've noticed over this last year is that I just see the same computer screen with the same motionless avatars. I mean, I just look at this little secretary here reading the paper, and sort of unconsciously, you have become that little person.
Oh, awesome.
And I, there's just a void in this context that sort of eats at one of the weaker parts of my psyche. Hmm. Is, you know, being, for lack of a better term, a recovering paranoid, there's still a lot of room where my brain takes flight and makes it difficult to, I don't know, to trust something. Mm-hmm. And so it, there's an element to this dialogue that, as it strengthens me in this very positive way, there's a part that always sort of picks on one of my weaker parts of my brain and sort of is slowly like attacking it. And,
well, that could be a good thing.
Probably.
I'm sitting in class on Tuesday, and I wasn't speaking, and everyone's going around me having a philosophical debate, right? And Babaji actually points at me, and like repeatedly, to like talk. And so basically, people were having this argument about why this fucking intellectual spinning around with these ideas, what the fuck is the point of this? It's all paradox anyway, was the, what somebody actually said. And so I responded with, you know, it feels like the purpose of Gyan, or at least one primary focus of Gyan, like yoga of the intellect, right, is the same as asana. So like stretching, asana, stretching literally means seat, right? Because you stretch so you can sit, so you can establish your seat. So like, not like people like think like lotus or whatever, but just so you can endure sitting, so you can do the actual practice, right? The actual practice is sitting. And so with Gyan, it's the same thing. And how do you become more flexible? You find your envelope. So you push yourself to find which should ultimately be a place of discomfort. If you're not finding any discomfort, then you're probably, then that's not really the work. You're not doing this just as a distraction. I mean, you could, one could be, but like, you know, intellect yoga is, it's, you have to find that envelope and endure it. And the longer you can endure it, the more flexible your mind becomes. And that's the purpose of embracing paradox. Because like you think paradox, you might think of like an M.C. Escher painting or something. But it's like paradox literally should create a degree of discomfort if you're looking at its implications. Like if it's a reality to consider what a paradox might actually mean. Like, you know, we throw around different, you know, ideas from psychology, like the death instinct and the pleasure principle being mutually interdependent. But like, what the fuck does that mean? Like, if you really consider that as an actuality and not just some, like, just entertaining it, like, I don't know, like you're, like it's cocktail party, talk or something, you know, it's like, so anyways, no, I feel like, yeah, like if information reaches a place, I don't know if that's what you're referring to, but, you know, I don't know. It's like you spin around with ideas until you suss out what's real in the ideas. You want the ideas to no longer simply be conceptual, but at the same time, you don't want to just like, you don't want to lie to yourself, like, but it shouldn't ever be a matter of that. Like if something's showing itself repeatedly, then you have to consider it, you know? And so that's the thing with synchronicity, is it's something that I can look at it this way or I can look at it that way. But when something just keeps coming up and I just, there comes a point, many points where I just have to like stop and be like, okay, what the fuck are you trying to tell me? You know?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, that makes it pretty clear. I think that's a nice, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's weird because this show is billed as a sync show. And it seems like sync work has to exist like anything on differing levels, right? Like there has to be more advanced levels of sync work. And I'm wondering if this show is continuing to do, like, is it strictly sync work, or have we integrated it so far that it's something beyond sync work, or do you identify like your splicing as sync work? Like, how do you sit with that terminology?
Well, as I'm doing that, I'm meditating on multiple levels of meaning of everything that I'm including. Like this last one that I just did is just like Shakina, Scarlet Woman, Beast, Scarlet Woman, Beast, Scarlet Woman, Beast, Scarlet Woman, Beast. Like that's the focus of the meaning of what's being communicated in Babylon. And so like I'm like just spinning around with those ideas the entire time I'm working on it. So it infuses the work with my meditation. So even though I'm taking images from various places, as I'm seeking those images out, I'm getting the images that are conveying like my artistic like representation of the thing, what I resonate with. So I'm like, I resonate with this image to communicate this idea. So I'm expressing beauty, lust, the card, you know, the arcana, and just like going into it, like what is the baseline, what's being communicated, and then where does this show up in culture? So I'll include imagery from that I can see the symbolism in films relating to that. So like Metropolis, obviously, like the silent film Metropolis, and then you know, including the sync that came out of that involving Gaga as a Scarlet Woman and what she's communicating there, and then Poltergeist, dude, fucking subliminal synchrosphere, holy. And after reading like two of that guy's whole posts, his two most recent posts,
yeah,
I was like, okay, I see why he's coming at it from this place. Like, you say what you want to, but like, because he's working on the same lines that we've been focused on. I feel like he filled in a lot of our, like, he took it to another level.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, fucking Heather O'Rourke, the little girl in Poltergeist, she gets sick the day of the fucking Super Bowl in 88, right? Did you read that part?
I read the last post. It must have been the previous one to that.
I'd noticed that poster before, and I never put that together. Like, in the background, in the fucking bedroom, kid's room, in Poltergeist, is a poster for, it says 1988.
No way.
Super Bowl. That film was filmed in 1982. Why is there a 1988? So that girl, this is fucked up.
That's fucked up.
Sick the day of the Super Bowl, dies the next day.
Or why is it reported that way?
What's that?
Why is it reported that way?
It's not reported that it's the day of the Super Bowl. It's just reported that this is the day.
Oh, really? Jesus.
Yeah. No, it's like total fucking mindfuck shit. So, like mind rape shit. Like, I don't know how to reconcile that, because I've been spinning around this correlation. And so, who's the football teams that are playing against each other? Fucking Detroit, San Diego, excuse me. San Diego, where she was born and died, okay, versus Colorado.
Well, with 237 on the television.
Exactly. So it's 237 on the television in Poltergeist. Fucking Channel 10 News, you see the tower, right?
Yeah. Guess,
the kids watching fucking Summer 42 in The Shining, okay? Fucking, what's the score of the game of Detroit versus Colorado? 10-2.
10-2?
10-42. Well. Dude, at Channel 10 when they're watching the football game in Poltergeist 2. That's another thing he showed. I never saw that. You zoom in on the television and they're watching fucking Channel 10.
Yeah.
Dude. Like, and then this the whole thing, they put the fucking Rams helmet on her. She's a sacrificial lamb, but then it's a football helmet. And then he ties it into fucking Beetlejuice, and you're like, obviously Beetle, the scarab, and the Dune connection with the sandworms and all of this. But at the end, when it's the fucking football players going up the stairs when she's singing fucking Shake Sonora, that was like, I mean, it sounds like a jump, but all the things involved in that are like totally connected. It's fucking bizarre.
It's, I had, for me, what felt like a breakthrough reading a complete one of his posts. And I messaged you to say that it reminded me of your blog, where there were just these epically long and detailed and flowing posts of connections that just, with each step, it just got deeper, bigger, weirder, scarier, funnier, and at the end of it, just being completely exhausted. I mean, it is like a drug, you know what I mean? You see the parallel between your posts and his posts, right?
I resonated with his approach for sure. I mean, I resonate with Jason Barrera's too quite a bit. I like that Jason Barrera doesn't spell everything out for you completely.
Mm-hmm.
The connections are there. And he makes it as blatant as possible. I mean, I think his explanation makes sense, that he's trying to help people become more symbol literate.
Mm-hmm.
And you can only become symbol literate if you can figure something out to yourself. But he brings you right to the edge. So can you add these together? Like, he takes you as far as he could take you further, but he holds back. And that holding back, I value. This guy is very... very overt. This is the chain. This is what I'm, you know. And so he at the beginning says his idea around what he feels it means, that there's, you know, that these guys are in the mystery school. But okay, here's one for you. Total mind fuck. The guy who I can't recall his name, but okay, Synchrosphere has an excerpt from the book of the guy who basically came up with the method that was used for THX sound, like the head fucking sound man who established THX sound, right?
Mm-hmm.
And was originally hired by George Lucas for the first Star Wars film. He was one of the head sound guys. And this is a book, apparently, not about mysticism or anything. It's just about his experience being a sound man. And there's one point in the book where he says, on the set of the first Star Wars, there was, quote unquote, adepts standing around the cameras as they were filming the film, projecting like psychic overlay or whatever into the projectors. Oh, into the cameras, excuse me. And like, he's just like, and he says it's very common, although people don't know about it. It's not like it's not a common knowledge thing. It is rather common, and he's seen it before with musicians in recording studios, that there'll be these people that are basically like mystery school adepts that are brought in. And so like, this is like a question of like, okay. And so, you know, and then the Steven Spielberg connection with Lucas throughout, like if you watch, so Spielberg helped Tobe Hooper do Poltergeist, and that's why you see Star Wars shit everywhere, right? Interestingly enough, Ridley Scott. Well, but this is the thing is that you have Lucas and Spielberg have this whole connection, and so that is interesting in and of itself. That there's this like it doesn't feel in the film like it's just like, oh, we're. It feels like there's something purposeful behind it beyond just like further advertising for like Star Wars. It's like significant. And what's there? It's like the fucking Darth Vader head and shit. Like, it's just, I don't know. There's something weird happening there. But anyways, even if you, whether you believe that in magic or whether you believe whatever, it's like you come across something like that and it's like, no, dude, well, he's not making that up. That's in his fucking book. Like, this is something that they believe. Like, and just to know that is just like, has to like make you take a step back, or at least it does for me, and just be like, what the fuck, dude? Like, wow. Like, and so he's also talks in the book at the same section about how George Lucas would discuss metaphysics with people. And it's like, he took that, the Force, seriously. Like, he's not just like making a science fiction fantasy thing. He's like, he believes in the Force. So that's what's in the movie. Like, that's, you know, that's fucking far out.
Well, it's a genius for him to have thought of the correct vehicle to represent his belief. That is his genius. And he should be, I guess, commended to a certain extent. As far as adepts, you know, making psychic overlays on cameras, I guess, you know, I would never think twice about a director when I was a kid who they would say, well, he had a priest come on and he blessed, you know, the cameras and the set so that good things could happen. Like, I wouldn't think twice about that, but I wouldn't necessarily believe that the priest had any power, even though I was a Catholic.
Right, right, right.
So I'm conflicted about that because it seems awfully, awfully strange, when it's not your tribe.
Yeah.
But, you know, I was thinking about the Book of Lies recently in regards to these, to sync blogs. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that you mentioned Barrera's ability to kind of put it in front of you, give you a few threads, but he's demanding of the reader to take the thread himself, to do the last part of the work himself. And I'm thinking of you know, when I read Book of Lies the first time, I had the standard issue copy with the commentary right next to it. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering what I would make, and that book was strange and frightening enough as it was, considering all the baggage, even for as little as Aleister Crowley was in the media when I was in high school in the mid-90s, I still at least knew of him. Albeit on a very, very slim and very delicate way. I mean, there's the Ozzy Osbourne song. There was just a tiny bit about it that I kind of knew what he was. And so when I saw the book, I had very strong Catholic reaction to it, deeper than I probably even realized. But I'm wondering what I would have thought of that book had it not had the commentary in it.
Hmm.
And would I have taken to that book, and would it have been a book that I read, I don't know, 30, 40 times throughout my life? That's one part of it. Second part of it, it is constructed kind of like a blog, where each chapter is kind of like a post. And sure. That book is sort of like, you know, 3 months where he just blogged these little things that came to him each day.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just, it seems like the perfect precursor, and not even a precursor, it is the thing itself. Everything else is sort of now a simulacrum of that book. When I think blog writers are writing effectively. So I kind of, there's this sort of thing that I would say with Jason Barrera now, and this is where you actually get into morality and everything, is if Jason, we'll take Jason Barrera for an example. Let's say he took, well, if we use the model, let's say he took 91 of his best blog postings, right? And was able to set them up uniquely in a sort of, I don't know, an ebook, because you have to include the video that he puts there. And he gave that away for free, just like it always has been, you know, 91 blog posts. But then if he had commentaries for each blog post, much like Crowley lets you in on what he put on the left-hand side of the page, but he charged for those commentaries.
Mm.
Now, does that strike some sort of evilness to it, or does it make it seem kind of unfair? So, like, you read one of his posts, and you read, like, 20 of them, and it really starts to, you start to wonder, and it opens up thoughts, and then you really just kind of want to know those little blank spots in your mind, and then it says, commentary to blog post one, $35. Now, at first, I think you would be kind of insulted, and you'd want to, you would probably reject Jason Barrera on some level. But if the free material is good enough and you finish all that, and it gets to a certain point where you just need to know what's behind door number one and door number two, that $35, what it means to you, starts to mutate and morph. And the next thing you know, you're paying $35 to see what his commentary is to one of his blog posts.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question. It's like Rob Agger, you know, it's like, he puts up so many videos for free and then eventually takes them down and charges for them if you want them. And he'll have ones that have never been put out to the public like that. You have to buy the fucking video. But you think about it, you know how much time and energy and everything, like research alone, like, and then everything else on top of it to get it together to have an actual product. It's like, yeah, I get it. I mean, you know how much fucking people charge for bullshit, but it's awesome, whatever, you know. I mean, there's it depends on what you're referring to. Is like, if you say, well, if you want the secret of it all, then you have, like, I'll give you all of this, but the real truth costs money. There's an interesting energetic that gets created in that. That's a little different. I mean, I understand that necessity, especially if somebody's like trying to survive, yet they're simultaneously dedicating their life to something. It's like, you know, I mean, Kickstarter like is huge, right? I mean, that's like just people who see a creative project that somebody's doing and want to encourage it. I mean, if you want somebody to continue their work and you value their work, then, you know, I get it. I'm not as down with like, that we're only going to give the 33rd degree secret for this much money, but we'll give you everything else along the way. But to get to the grand whatever, that hierarchical kind of energetic kind of shifts it a little bit, I think. But
there is no 33rd degree secret. The whole point of the order is to create a void in your brain to believe there is a 33rd degree secret.
Sure.
Right? So you put yourself in a discipline and in a structure to create this space in your mind that is being attacked 24 hours a day trying to understand. And but at least in this order, they dangle down the road that there will be some revelation that, you know, this is the thing that keeps you going. And then at certain points, one would say corrupt organizations demand money from you. But curiously, those are the organizations that seem to work. That money on some level seems to be... We don't understand really what money is. We just see it for its vulgar nature right now, right?
Yeah, we don't really... It's a fucking snake.
So I think that, like, going back to that Jason Barrera thing is, he would, the funny thing would be that if he gave you his blog post for free, anything that he's going to tell you is already in there, right? If he charged $35 for a commentary to one of his blog posts, it could be argued that he's not going to tell you anything that you can't already get out of the blog post yourself. It just is going to take a lot of time to get there. And then you can call it a leap of faith or you can call it an aha moment. But he would say, you would be able to grok and write the commentary yourself if you just spent more time with it.
Yeah, that's true.
So the money thing is really just for suckers. It's a fast forward button that sort of demolishes the towers. It robs you of the chance of ever really getting to the place that you really want to go to. And I find that to be just a fascinating element that I don't think is really well discussed. Or it's not explicitly discussed. I think Crowley says it obviously right there in the Book of Lies with the gold bricks chapter and a sucker is born every minute. Mm-hmm. It's pretty funny that he just tells you right there. Especially in the 40s and 50s and 60s when people were paying outrageous amounts for anything Crowleyan. You know, think of the money that Jimmy Page spent on Crowley books. I know I would have probably done the exact same thing if I was Jimmy Page in my castle with my 16-year-old wife and my pounds of pure white heroin.
Danny Carey, the drummer for Tool, his website has changed, but his original website, just mainly what his website was Crowley books that he owned, pictures of his Crowley books and descriptions of what the books are. He spent millions of dollars.
Really?
Millions of dollars on Crowley early editions, yeah. Fucking far out. And then he used all of that for the music. So it's not just like he actually applied everything there to his work. So there's actual sigils inside of his drum set to know the specifics of what to call in, because he resonates with that, and so he runs with it. Yeah, pretty far out.
But see, that brings into question the whole notion of authority. That anyone could have taught Danny Carey about sigil magic, but
right.
Coming through the authority of a $1 million text with Aleister Crowley's name on it, one of 200 copies. That provided the authority necessary for him to actually do the magic.
Well, he wanted it as virgin as possible, and that's the argument with anything that's, because the book itself is taken to be a magical thing in the first place. Like it's got energy in it beyond. It's not just like, and so that's the argument for the. You know, something on a computer screen, you know, it's like you need something as virgin as possible, as close to the source as possible.
Which is, that's a sucker thing.
That's a sucker thing for sure.
Yeah.
It's not a sucker thing when it comes to the explanation of, like, if you're going to make a wand, you want to get you the only reason why you want to make it yourself, cut the fucking tree with a blade that you yourself fucking ored and forged, like, is because you're getting in touch with the elements in the process of doing so. And the more in touch you are with the elements themselves and anon, like, you want to feel such a connection with the thing that you're holding that you feel one with it. Because if it's going to be an extension of you, if you're really going to have a sense that something's an extension of you, you have to feel the elements as an actuality. Like, if something's in your hand, you have to know that it's like, how does this connect to me? So if you go to the fucking trouble to ore and get the materials, like, of anything, then you're in the dirt, like, you're in the earth, like, you're one with the object because you saw how that object came emerged from the thing that you yourself are not separate from. And so that I can understand.
But the magic then actually becomes the authority in your own head that has no doubt where this wand came from. The power really is in your own mind, ultimately.
I
It's
mean,
not
what?
in the wand. I guess you can use the wand to trick other people who aren't as savvy as you, because you will have a confident authority in your own brain. But isn't the goal to transcend that degree? Like,
Yeah.
it's fun to play with that wand for a while, and there's a lot of fun adventures that you can do. I think it's funny how magic and magicians now are best represented as a teenage boy or teenage kids.
Bear Bears movie.
I mean, Harry Potter is basically saying all the depths of magic are learned in high school.
Right.
Whereas magic used to be the 80-year-old man in the tower with the dragons. You know, magic has come down from the mountain and into the schools.
Sure. Sure.
But that just tells you that do the teenagers have the power now? No. Magic isn't the most powerful thing anymore. Well, I
Well,
guess that's an interpretation one
yeah,
could take.
an interpretation of magic as well. Like, I would consider what Edward Bernays did to be,
Oh, well, that's it.
Oh, but then Crowley makes the argument that potato farming is magic. Anytime you're environment through your will, you're manipulating material. And he's just saying that, it can happen on subtler and subtler levels. So you're, and this is actually, this connects directly into, I've been looking recently at David Bohm's work again, kind of revisiting it a little bit, and the wholeness and the implicit order, and looking at how he, when he looks at the mind, he looks at the mind itself as material. So anything that the mind's doing, it's becomes an extension of what matter itself, as we know it, is doing. So if you figure out what's going on with the material, you're also figuring out what's going on with the mind, and vice versa, because the mind itself, the structure of the mind, is itself emerging out of its environment. And so it sees itself as a separate entity that has its own sets of rules. But ultimately, those rules completely follow. And so that's the argument for, like, Edward Bernays being a magician, which also gives it substantiates your argument with the sucker thing, and also the fact that this stuff is in plain sight. And not only that, but Edward Bernays pushed it to be in plain sight by popularizing Freud to the public. Like, he wants. And, like, we probably wouldn't even know who Freud is nearly to the degree that we do if it wasn't for Edward Bernays popularizing him. So he's using this stuff to manipulate people, and people are like, oh, that bastard Edward Bernays, which he was a bastard. But at the same time, he's trying to educate people to what's going on simultaneously so that they see it. And there's an interesting thing to be said about the nature of an insight that happens when you've already, like, if you've been manipulated in some way, and then you come to understand how you've been manipulated, there's an energetic that's created that it's not just about negativity. It's like about Rajas Guna. It's about like the Rajasic reaction that is actually liberating. Depending on what you do with that, you know, it doesn't always have to be a negative thing to have a energetic response to something that's been, you know, that you've been manipulated by. And so I don't know. I feel like it's just an interesting thing that, yeah, he's manipulating people, but yeah, he's trying to fucking alert them to how they're being manipulated simultaneously.
He's a sly fucker because I guess, is it fair to say that Edward Bernays perfected propaganda?
Well, he said that literally, he's quoted as saying that public relations is propaganda. It's just people wouldn't accept a word like propaganda after what the Nazis did with it in World War II.
Perfect. So I would say that what this for me, Edward Bernays and propaganda and changing it to public relations is the perfect example. Like if anyone has ever had trouble really getting Marshall McLuhan's "The Medium is the Message," this is the thing to focus on, because propaganda is a medium. It's not a message. You can put any message you want into it. That's irrelevant. The thing that is working on you, the thing that is infecting you or controlling you or creating your reality is the medium, is the propaganda. So when you have a war of Democrats versus Republicans, both of them are using propaganda. That means 100% of the population is being affected by the medium. The contents of which are irrelevant, because whoever wins is going to win through the medium of propaganda, ensuring that anyone who tries to topple them will have to use the same medium. They will naively think that they're selling something different because they're injecting the propaganda with a different message, but no, they're just doing the exact same thing. And if you can kind of understand that, I think that's where you get into Terence McKenna's whole rap about culture is not your friend. And what he really meant was that culture is a medium, and this medium that we're in the Western world, is thoroughly built on a foundation of propaganda. And that is recognizing that you're swimming in that is the fish recognizing that it's in water. It's a thoroughly profound aha moment. And once that occurs, you are never the same person, right? You can't... You forget how to breathe because you realize it shouldn't be happening. It's impossible, or something like that.
It's just the only thing is that it could probably be argued that after you've seen it, and then when you still compromise, if ignorance having like its basis in ignoring, like ignorance, you know,
mm-hmm.
It's like the worst energetic kind of ignorance, because if you know something but you're like, I don't know what to do about that, and then you go about your business as usual, you create another level of an energetic there that's even further entrenched in a sense, because you can't look at things the same way. But if you try to, it's like instant karma, you know. It's kind of combustion or something, which I've considered in the stages of alchemy, like you say, separation, coagulation, reuniting, that could be even an essential part of the coagulation process. Because I mean, how often does somebody just have the insight and then that's done? They're already like, you know, Kaivalya Samadhi. Like, no, it's like there's a breakdown that occurs with every insight because you fall back into whatever you're coming from. How often does anybody just like move forward? You know, like, I don't know, we're not in a situation. And so I feel too, like that's one of the values of like practice. And I would like, whatever the practice happens to be, not that you should ascribe to a particular culture's model, but just to have something to go back to. So you're not just falling back into, I mean, it's going to be relative chaos no matter what. But at the same time, something like, I was thinking about what happened with the Beatles, with just the White Album, and like they're coming out of this meditation. They did real work. They did it's the basis for all cults on one level, but it's also the basis of you know, gaining spiritual foothold within yourself is to basically break apart the ego. And so, like, they did that work. They were just complete, like, they opened up a space within themselves, but then they come out of it into what? Like, what the fuck is that? Like, if there's anything to explain the incredible amount of synchronicities surrounding the White Album and Rosemary's Baby and the Manson killings and all of these correspondences beyond these people just happening to like be planning something or to do, you know, like the unconscious levels of it seem to be having just chaos to fall back on. And the fact that everybody's listening to them, they cut a record and that record's distributed. Not only is everybody fucking listening to it on a mass scale, like it's become like a massive meme, but like those people listening to it are on fucking mind altering substances that are leaving them completely vulnerable, like psychically vulnerable to whatever is being communicated. And if the artists themselves don't even know what the fuck is going on at this point, they're just communicating, like they're just pulling things out of the ether basically and putting them together. And like, I mean, that's how those kind of things seem to happen.
It's that's like fucking gorgeous, man. Because if I never really saw it that way, that, you know, the White Album, all the seeds of those songs sort of took root when they were on their retreat in India, right? Yep. And I don't know, were they getting newspapers every day in their commune, wherever they were staying? I mean, were they keeping touch with the news of the world, or were they completely removed?
I believe they were completely removed. But even like beyond that, they were, you know, getting down into, like, they're basically bringing up the storehouse of the unconscious and relinquishing their network of correspondences. And so they become fresh to make new correspondences, but those new correspondences aren't attached consciously. They're coming out of this thing. They're completely open, and it's just like flooding in, new correspondences just flooding in. And so like, and then, but it's one thing when that happens for an individual, that's impactful. But it's another thing when it happens for people who are literally like what it means to record something in the first place. Like if you're like to record a moment of your life, like, you know, with a camera or with audio, that is a powerful thing. Like you're taking time and you're reproducing it. Like to cut a record is a magical act in a sense. Like it's, you know, it's really something. The fact that you can take that and then play it backwards. I mean, how long have we been able to listen to people speak backwards?
Yeah, no, ridiculous.
And like that is a, like that's something people make humor about. Like, oh, they say Satan backwards. They say Satan when you play it backwards or something with like Led Zeppelin or whatever. And it's like, you know, whatever they fucking say. Like if you hear something said forward when you play it backwards, yeah, that's cool. This is a message from old Pink, you know. But I think that there's something about just the fact that we can do that. Like that is like a weird fucking achievement, underworld like achievement kind of thing. Like just that's possible. And so, you know, I don't know. I look at like what are our advances, and I think some of our lesser acknowledged or appreciated things are actually more advances than we realize. They're just advances on other levels. And so you know, like you listen to Revolution Number 9 on the White Album and it's filled with backwards. They're playing it backwards and you're listening to it forwards in the first place. It's like, you know, I mean, beyond the fact that William S. Burroughs was showing John Lennon how to play, like he was playing Phonograph records backwards at the towards the beginning of the Beatles' career. Like, you know, that's just, that's, and he's obviously a Thelemite to the max, you know? And so it's just, I don't know. It's interesting.
I've thought of that before as well. I always connected the backward playing of the phonographs to, and I can't place the exact reference, but there's a sort of, it's either a Golden Dawn type of ritual or a Crowleyan thing with the barbarous names.
Yeah, he says it in book 4.
Okay.
in Magic Theory and Practice, right? He says, or play, and in the same place where he says, in order to learn to speak backwards, practice saying, I am he. And then where is the fucking classic backwards message?
Yeah. I am.
We are all together. I could probably find it right now. I actually got Theory and Practice right here while we're talking. But yeah, it's just, it's the same page. They're right next to each other where he says practice playing. He recommends practicing playing phonograph records backwards as a way to learn to speak backwards. He's saying that musicians should learn to speak backwards, which is fucking trippy.
Yeah, that, like, it's so simple and so elegant and so innocent with some perspective on it. And so funny in how it threatened so many people and caused so much trumped up concern that it almost seems forced. That how could anyone be threatened by playing a record backwards? Mm-hmm. I just think that that is one of the ingrained components of the Gutenberg galaxy of print, you know, that it just is, each letter is in its own place and marches forward in one direction, and you don't break line because then you break the division and you destroy the whole. And it's just so silly that that could be something. God, you know, what was it? McKenna was saying something, I listened to him say the other day about how he was so happy that, it was like in the late 90s that we were nearing the end of the 20th century. And that to say 20th century started to sound like when people would say the 19th century. Because when you invoke the 19th century, he says most people in their minds, they think of those stodgy old people way back in the dirty past who really were up against this insurmountable challenge, but they did their best, and they did their best, and they made mistakes, but thank God we're now in the 20th century where we're so enlightened. And he's saying that thank God we're at a point where when you say the 20th century, it's now replacing the 19th century, and we can think of the 21st century, that, you know, we're in the light of clarity now. We've put the 20th century behind us. Because the 20th century is just comical now that we're out of it. It's, granted, tragic, brutal, horrifying. But the components of what were sold to us as the causes for it, because most of it is bullshit, it just is, it's just crazy, right?
Yeah.
I mean, just the arguments people made for why they had to do awful things are just falling apart and becoming ridiculous. And it is impressive now that in the 20th century, people are allowed to notice its ridiculousness. Just like people in the 19th century didn't know that germs existed, you know? Or in the 16th century, people who'd studied geometry were into demonic magic that, you know, these labels are just so fucking ludicrous.
Propaganda. Don't believe anything people say about germs. I know better than that. Shit.
Oh my God. But yeah, just thinking of the Beatles in India, removed from the chaos that they had left, but being so, like, that telepathic umbilical cord that they were still tied to, that it was all funneling into their brains regardless, that they couldn't get away from it, that it found them, or that they, you know, that they were still tapped into what was going on, because, I mean, yeah, to be John Lennon in 1968, that's a powerful receptor.
That's the thing. So I thought, so Alan made a comment about that film, that Cronenberg film, Existenz.
Yeah.
How, you know, there's these ideas around, like, the subliminal gay agenda or whatever, and they use that film to emphasize it. And he was pointing out that that was not even a B movie necessarily, like
Yeah.
that is. And so I was thinking about how, I mean, I thought about this before, but it's just like what it means for, like, in the same way we're saying that the book or the magical tool should be as virgin as possible or whatever, it's like kind of the same line of thinking. And I wonder where the superstition ends, but it seems like, I mean, pretty straightforward that the more like popularized something becomes, the more or widespread, and the more it gets embedded in the collective psyche. It's like the 100th monkey thing, right? You're like, okay, well, this many people, if something reaches critical mass, then it becomes influential on a deeper level. It like builds itself into the archetypes. And so I wonder about, like, even like in the past, why, like, the way that mythologies were spread and the way that the archetypes were emphasized repeatedly to like instill them, how that relates to like with like that's feels like the value of what we're doing here is looking at, well, if pop culture is playing with these same kind of ideas or whatever, but then look like introducing them through different from different angles and whatnot to the masses, that like the things that are the that like cut the deepest are the things that the like the majority of people are listening to. And so that's like why I'm particularly fascinated with my realizations around the work of Lady Gaga, is that like that makes it so like just, you know, it in a way it just makes it cooler that like, you know, the girls like listening to Dancing in the Dark, Dancer in the Dark, who are like in high school and like completely oblivious to the meaning of the song having to do with that, who's dancing in the dark, like who's unconscious of what they're actually dancing to, and what's actually being communicated. It's in re like with that in specifically related to the meanings of Metropolis. From either a Kabbalistic perspective or whatever, an archetypal perspective of like the story of Babylon and what she's fucking talking about. Like that's the song where she says, "Find your Jesus, find your Kubrick," by the way. But
Yeah.
I'm just using that as an example that there's like, and it's so poppy and it's so just like fucking cheeseball. It's like there's even more power in like if you have a hook, like they call that a hook. Like if you have the song that's like they say, like for music producers, like they can tell within the first 30 seconds of a song if a song's going to be a hit
Yeah.
because they listen for the hook. They're like, does it have the hook? And so you have like Saadi, you know, Saadi is not the star. You got to have a hook, you know. But I don't know. I was thinking of that, and it kind of the headline, the hook. Yeah, totally.
That's how people get people to read articles. Half the shit that's on the internet nowadays will have a headline like, what was the other day? A law in California will ban protesters from public transportation. And the mind goes, that's fucking bullshit. That's cause for revolution. You click on the little link, you read the article, and that's not what the law's about at all.
Right.
The headline is the thing that 50% of the people won't even read the article. They'll just see that and go, yeah, the fucking man, fuck him. Now they're gonna take public transportation away from people trying to protest. That would be fascism. That would be communist. That would be or whatever you want to call it. That would be insane. But it's a lie. It's not real. But it got me to at least click on the link to see, okay, what the fuck is this about? And then when you read it, you realize, oh, you could just throw that headline away, and the headline should be, if you attack a police officer and piss on him at a protest, you could possibly be banned from taking public transportation. It's basically saying the meat of the law is if you continually start fights or create a public disturbance while on public transportation, you could possibly lose your right to take public transportation. And that could
Yeah.
extend to if you're a public nuisance at protests, You could also be, this could be also be a component of the law. So it's a lot more complex than that headline wants it to be. So, you know, a pop song needs to grab you with the force that that headline grabbed me. But I don't know if people realize that that is a contagion. It's like, it's propaganda. It's using the tools that Edward Bernays, he refined magic to that level, right? It's far more complex than that. And that's what makes a pop song like Lady Gaga a holographic object, because it realizes that, you know, the music is going to grab this percentage of people. The words are going to grab this percentage of people. The combination of both is, it's a multi-tiered object. And it's designed that way. It doesn't happen by accident. There are very, very smart people who are designing this sort of holographic object that is being sold not only through music, but through image, through live performance, through film, via video. I mean, it's really, oh, it's a work of architecture more than art at first, right?
Right. Completely. See, that's what I've been... Okay, so I've been thinking a lot about Dürer's Melancholia.
God damn, yeah.
And so, and the way that every aspect is... So you have the compass in the middle, and then everything throughout it is using the same line ratio, so that it in itself, the whole thing becomes a matrix, because it's repeating the same pattern over and over and over again, in the same way that the magic square to the right of it is, what is it, 37, I think? Something like, 30, I forget, 34 maybe? Anyways, that any way you slice it, not only if you do it, if you take any line and go up or down, you know, you have the number. And if you go side by side, any way, you have the number. If you go diagonal through the whole thing in either direction, you have the number. If you take the four corners and add them up, you have the blocks of the corners, and you add them up, you have the number. If you take the middle square in the middle, the block, you have the number. It's like, any way you slice this, you come up with the same fucking thing. And so that's architecture. And like, that's like, you look at Scott Onstott's, is that how you pronounce it? Scott Onstott?
I think so.
If you look at his work, he's like, this is all in plain sight, but it's like, however you get this, you're going to get this. Like, and like, that is the point at which, so there's this line with that I keep finding with synchronicity, where I'm like, here's a synchronicity, and it's happening, and it's like, wow, that's far out. But then there's the point at which you can see the human hand. It's like somebody's fingerprints are on something.
Okay.
It was like when I watched, like I was saying, for example, like the film Melancholia with the album Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness of Smashing Pumpkins, and there's the title song ends with the last piano notes when you start it from the point at which I found that I chose that point because of 100 other points throughout the entirety of the film that would land if I started it here. And then what do you know, when I get to the end, it's all the little piano.
It's the best feeling in the world at times. It just is.
Yeah, at Lars Van Trier's name. And then it's like, oh, that's when it ends. I'm like, that's like somebody's fucking fingerprints. And it wasn't until that point that I had to be like, okay. Like, it was like, you can see the, and I don't know for sure, because I haven't fucking talked to the guy. And I don't know, even if I did, if he would say, oh, you got me. You know, just like Stanley Kubrick with Dr. Strangelove. Oh, you saw the sexual subtext throughout the film? Awesome. Yeah, I was waiting for somebody to find that, you know. But like, that's like the point at which you're like, those are fingerprints. Like, those are like, they fucking, somebody fucking did that. Like, that's not nature. That's like, nature has a very high order, and things are expressed the same dynamics over and over again. Yeah, I dig it. The golden ratio, like, actually, the golden ratio doesn't occur in nature, but the Fibonacci sequence, you know, occurring throughout everything. We regard things as beautiful the closer they get to the golden ratio, even though we don't find the golden ratio occurring exactly in nature. We find things approaching that. And so nothing, maybe something reaches that perfection, but generally it just works around this framework and twists around it, you know. But anyways, it's just, I don't know. That's really interesting with architecture where you find like these things occurring. And it's like, oh, they fucking knew some, like the diameter of the earth, the diameter of the moon, the diameter of the sun, and relating it and all to each other in our architecture from fucking way back when. Like, that's crazy, you know? So we're not supposed to know this stuff yet. How is it there? The Fibonacci sequence is in the Torah. When you take, what is it, the tree in the garden in relationship, the word for the in Hebrew of the tree in the garden in relationship to Eden, I think it might be the Garden of Eden in Hebrew. I forget what it is, but anyways, you can come up with the Fibonacci sequence from something how long before Fibonacci himself? Like, how is that there? I don't know. It's just the like, no, that feels like fingerprints to me. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like this. It's like the average lifespan of people 2,000 years ago was like, 30 years old. But that doesn't mean that someone couldn't live to be 93. It's just most people died at birth. Most people, and if you lived to like 15, the average age would have been like 50. But there were a good amount of people who lived into their 90s. But to live into your 90s would probably depend upon a certain kind of lifestyle. And I think that that certain kind of lifestyle would not be fighting in armies, working, hard labor. I think that these would be our intellectuals. So mirror this with, even though they didn't have IQs back then, probably the average IQ 2,000 years ago, let's just say if we're going to use the same scale of 0 to 100, was probably 30. But if you lived to 15, your IQ probably would approach 50. But that doesn't mean that people back then, that there were certain individuals with an IQ that approached 93, just like they have today. The problem is they didn't have the same kind of vocabulary to express the vision of their intelligence. So they used architecture as their language, right? Architecture is a complex arrangement of form that creates beauty, which approaches what our conception of God is. Because that's that whole the good, the true, and the beautiful. The good is, entirely subjective. The true is unprovable, but beauty is something undeniable. It's like the purest state. So I think these people with these high IQs back then, they had very little people to talk to have conversations with on the same level. So they transformed their knowledge into architecture. So that becomes the whole Freemasonic thing, right? And painters embedding codes within their paintings, it seems to fit into place so perfectly for me. And the fact that nowadays people who have learned this architecture, it's not inconceivable that they would say, hey, what if we just apply this to pop music? What could we accomplish? And I think Lady Gaga is that sort of. And it's beautiful that you link it to Metropolis with the robotic lady. It was like, let's see what we can build. Let's see what we can give the people to love and see if they give us money. It's a beautiful, it's beautiful detective work on your part, I think.
Well, I can't figure out if it's subversive or if it's the epitome. That's fucking far out. I can't tell if it's a manipulation or to control, or if it's an encouragement to liberate.
Over a long period of time, it always affords liberation, I think, because there's secrets in plain sight, and it's whatever you want to do with the architecture. You can build prisons or you can build palaces, right? You can, but at least the knowledge is encoded and it's out there, and it's not locked up, and it's not being kept secret. It's just all around us now. It's just, I don't know. I just don't think it can be a nefarious manipulation. There's some part of the brain in a 15-year-old who's, that's the thing. There's a part of your brain that's getting it. It's just a matter if it's going to come to the surface or not. If you're going to start legalizing marijuana in America, well, this shit is just going to start erupting out of people. There are going to be people in their 50s and 60s who've never tried marijuana who are going to turn on to marijuana for the first time. And imagine the fertile soil of those brains that are going to start to just explode, man. And then they're just, you know, a hop, skip, and a jump away from turning on to something psychedelic. And think of the revolution that's going to be. I mean, it's going to be, you know, the Summer of Love is stereotypically the teenage and 20-something set. But there's going to be this Winter of Love with this whole generation that missed it. But really, they're just these vessels that are super saturated and are going to just be touched by this gratuitous grace. And what they're going to see and what they're going to be able to do with that is going to be mind-blowing.
I hope it's not the nuclear Winter of Love.
I don't think it's going to be a nuclear Winter of Love.
When the summer's gone. Oh boy. Yeah, that's like, I've kind of had theorized, you know, where will we be when the summer's gone? Cause it sure fucking feels like summer when it's fall here still. So I don't know. Yeah.
You're not going to have a creepy old guy at the club. Well, I guess you always have creepy old guy at the club. There was one meme that was being circulated about Rave Dad at Coachella, I think it was. Did that cross your eyes?
No, but it's gotten to the point now that, of course, like, you know, people have been raving for long enough for there to be, you know, it's not going to be long before there's Rave Grandpa showing up at the party. But he's been doing it since he was in his 30s, so, you know.
The thing I didn't like about this was that the way Rave Dad meme was being presented was there's this spirit at a rave that, well, okay, I was lucky enough to go to raves in Chicago in 94 and 95. And being a pretty square white kid from the suburbs, to be in this urban environment with this music that, you know, I had at least enough knowledge of music from the 60s and 70s and 80s and the new music coming out, that to realize that this music being created in this environment was just boundary pushing, right? It was incredible. I was just so lucky to be, feel like I was in a sacred space where a new art form was being perfected right in front of my eyes, right? And the thing that was overwhelming about the environment was, hey, you're here for the music. No one's judging you based on what you dress or what you wear or how you dance. It's just a matter of, are you in the energy? Like, are you feeling it? Are you hearing it? Because it's pretty goddamn amazing. It really felt like something in California in the 60s. You know what I mean? Where it was just, if you were there, that's all that mattered. You didn't have to have the right pin or the right clothes. It was just, you're here? Well, there's a reason you're here. It all makes sense. So It was embracing. So Rave Dad, there's a certain element of course there should be Rave Dad. Of course that guy should be there. He's there. He made it there. He knows what he was attracted to that place. He shouldn't have his video taken of him. He shouldn't have pictures taken of him to be presented on the web, because at minimum, 50% of that is laughing at it and condemning it and judging it as one of these doesn't belong here. And the other half is like spreading it around and like, hey, this is great that Rave Dad is here. This is what Rave's all about. But I think it's so corrupted now that the simple fact that he's singled out is a judgment of separation. It's antithetical to the whole point of a rave.
Right.
And I just think it's so lost on people who even think that they're making a positive comment about it. We shouldn't know Rave Dad at all. There shouldn't be Rave Dad. There should just be ravers. The energy doesn't discriminate. And so, I don't know. I don't know if this is, it's a good sign that, I don't know if it's a good or a bad sign, but it sticks out. I don't know.
Amy and I have a lot of electronic events. It's like, you know, it's our thing. And she has her friends that have their, that are the crew, and I have my friends as crew. And so hers is Strategic, mine is Nexus and Rain Dance. And we've both been involved for years with these people. And there's one man who shows up at events and he makes this sound the whole time like a dying moose as stands there, and he's got like a staff, and he just goes like, what the fuck? And he just does it and does it, and people are just having a bad trip around him. They're like, fucking stop it. And he just keeps going through the whole event. And you know, somebody would walk up to Amy, and she, one of her friends, and was like, he's on your team, you know, like he went and she was trying to talk to him to find out what his deal is outside, you know, and like, I was having a hard time the night that this happened with that guy. Like, he was just like wearing on me. I'm just like, oh my God. Like, I feel like my face is melting in the first place, and this guy is not helping me. And anyway, she's asking him why he does what he does. And he has a camp at Burning Man called Fuck Burning Man. And his daughter... He takes his daughter every year, and she and him wear the same shirt that says Fuck Burning Man. And it's just like, they're like the Fuck Burning Man camp, but they go to parties and they're there. Their whole purpose is to challenge people to basically like to embrace the chaos of everything. Like, they have this whole philosophy that they're bringing to the table, and so yeah, embrace the cancer, exactly. And so, you know, it's like that, you it's like I think it may have been John in the Yellow Submarine cartoon, and goes, you know, you ever get the feeling that things might not be as rosy as they appear on the surface, you know? People go to events to like get away from it all, and he's like, no, you should go to these events to face shit. And like, but nobody, like, it's annoying as fuck because you're trying to have a pure, just, you know, just positive event. And he's just bringing this, like, ugh! And, but I try and avoid being around the guy. And it's unfortunate that he goes right to the front and does that. But at the same time, it's like, fucking whatever. Like, that's, you know, like, You gotta bring equanimity. It's like, you know, as like I was saying, just with this Vipassana thing I just did, it's like, you can be in excruciating pain. And if it's something that's inevitably happening right now, you have to, and yeah, not only do you have to endure it, but to bring equanimity to it, it itself becomes, a contributor to the liberating process. Like, the very things that you see as a hindrance to your own growth can actually contribute to it, especially if they're like unavoidable. Like, the thing is, when that guy's there, you want to be like, well, I could tell this guy to shut up, and maybe if I tell him enough times, or if enough people do, he will, or we kick him out, you know. But there's also like a reflection that happens of us wanting to shut out what makes us uncomfortable. So like, here I live in, you know, Santa Cruz in California, where there's a huge homeless population. And they go and try and sleep out in the woods, and they'll get tickets for money. Like, they get charged for if they get caught sleeping in the woods, as if them sleeping in the woods was like their vacation choice or something that they're being, you know, like, they're not sleeping in the woods for the fun of sleeping in the woods. They're sleeping in the woods because they have no other choice. And so if you charge the money, that's kind of fucked up. But there's something in an energetic happening there of, could you just die? Could you just go away? And just let me like live it up. And so a lot of these events are like imitating, in a way, like the Bohemian Grove, or like some like elitist like kind of thing. And so, you know, that's like, and people almost want that, or crave that, or feel like they they need that, like they relate to it, like, oh, look where we are and look what we're doing. We're on top of the world. And you know, I mean, I can say for myself, like, being in San Francisco, sneaking through, like going to what is already a Renegade that they're charging $15, $20 for, going, I'm like, oh, well, it's a warehouse. Going through a back door, sliding down a conveyor belt down two stories, with like a giant fucking bar that I had to like wedge myself under, and then going through a fucking another door and another door through the dark, and then ending up in the party all of a sudden. And then it's like the party that when I was in junior high was my ideal. Like I watched some. You know, I go to what we call Moon Tribe, which is like we throw renegades, but like
Renegade would be like an underground, non-sanctioned event.
outdoors normally, which is amazing. You know, that was how my introduction to the electronic scene was through like parties in the woods and whatnot. But to like be like, okay, right now I am at the absolute like zenith of what is the classic underground rave. And I'm like, now I'm at a rave, and like there's a feeling that comes with that that's like you're on top of the world, like
Absolutely, absolutely.
in it. This is it. This is what I wanted. And so that there's an aspect of that that I can relate to, like almost imitating the elite, because the elite is like, look, we've made it. We're here. We're fucking at Bohemian Grove. We're in front of the fucking owl. Like we're gonna have some sex. We're gonna take some drugs. Probably we're gonna do whatever. Like there's a feeling that they get, and I think it's the same fucking feeling, and that we're all imitating each other, and so that really makes me wonder. Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense because it's the same thing. Like I in high school, I didn't drink. I didn't go to the woods where all the kids would congregate and there would be parties. I wasn't in that. I was pretty straight laced. But I didn't drink or smoke pot, and I just fell in love with music. And part of that, I think, is I associate with the availability of quality music. The headphones, like Walkmans, came around. Like it was pretty new, and the ability to get lost in music. And I think, you have a lot of time to kill when you're a teenager if you're not going out having sex, getting drunk, and getting into trouble. Music became that portal, and I was always looking for what was not, I wasn't listening to the mainstream. I was getting into independent music and stuff that no one in my high school had heard of. So to actually find where that music was being played in the city, not in like the clubs where you had to be 21 or 18, but you just had to know where it was. And you'd go to Wax Trax Records and you'd pay your money and you'd get this little map, and then you'd drive into the city and go to this warehouse or an abandoned school. And there would just be this whole world. And not only that, the best music you ever heard in your life, I mean, it was, and it wasn't in a, an exclusive resort, and there wasn't, it clearly wasn't the place where rich or money had any value, but it was everything that I was looking for. And I'm remembering now just how absolutely completely satisfied with the universe I was, that I had found that place. And everyone needs to have that, everyone has that place in some form, And yeah, I think that threat of elitism is when it creeps into your mind that no, this is the only place, or this is better than other people's places. No, it's just that was what it was. And I don't think I'll ever find a place like that again right now. I think it was so specific to that time in my life that all the components of finding that place were was the architecture of it. But
Right, carries the secret chamber energetic, which is the same thing that comes. It's like why they emphasize like secrecy and not just masonry, but throughout the mystery schools, is because that secret chamber that you find, that's like the veiled, like you know, like the just the place that where something's happening. It's like important, but nobody, like hardly anybody knows about it, that carries an energetic, and it's like the same energetic. And you're like, oh, I'm a part of it. And you're sharing it with like the secret club. Like that's totally like the what can happen at times with the like the underground rave. And it's just the underground phenomenon. And so like you were mentioning, like you're relating it to like the 60s, and it's like in San Francisco or wherever, you know, it's like that there was this thing happening, and it was like, oh, are you hip to it? Are you a part of it? And that energetic of like when eyes meet and you're like, oh yeah, we're in the same we're jiving right now. Like that's what people look for, and that's what some people crave, and some people don't know about that, and so they don't even fucking care because they're not, you know, or they feel like negative towards it because of, you know, whatever they, you know, judgments they have around it, which some of those judgments could very well, but you know, it's just that there's something to be said about that, like when you get this the secret knowledge, you know.
I'll say right now, for me, the one place I'll say is and I started doing this about a year ago, is I'll get up at like 4:45 in the morning. I'll take the Blue Line L train into the city, downtown Chicago, and walk past Buckingham Fountain, across Lakeshore Drive to the lakefront, and I'll smoke as the sun rises. And it'll be around 5:30, 5:40 in the morning. And I'll be the only motherfucker out there. And I'll walk towards the Museum of Natural, Thiel Museum, and I'll look out over the city, and it's as if the entire place is fucking empty. There's just not anybody up walking around. And it's just the most beautiful cathedral that one could even imagine. I mean, it's just astonishing, this skyline and this lake and the sunrise, and obviously smoking a little bit. And it's like this secret temple for like 1 hour before all the joggers come out and start running around. So, yeah. You know, actually, I have to go to work, dude.
Oh, you gotta go. You're done.
Yeah. Okay. So, I don't know. I haven't heard from Alan. It doesn't look like he's online. So I'm imagining that this is the show for this week.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's nice to talk to you. I don't know how you're still feeling about everything or how you're going to feel about everything, but you know, we have guests too, you know, like it's not all about us what you referred to as rehashing.
Yeah. You know, I think what I wanted to do was I wanted to sort of address this for like, you know, on the air. I wanted to record this conversation and just kind of, if I had the opportunity to kind of air out some of these things in my head, I wanted to kind of dump it into the show just for the sake of the show, the whole concept of the show. And it's still something I'm reflecting upon, but at least you know where my head is at.
Yeah, regard. I kind of you have expressed in the past your some of the things that you expressed today to a degree, and so you didn't like completely catch me off guard with that. But it would be nice to have Alan in that conversation as well, to hear his feedback or what he's feeling himself in that regard. So, but anyways, it's great talking to you today, and, yeah, I'd say, take it easy. And, as it stands, I guess I'll hear you next week.
Absolutely. And, happy anniversary, David.
Man, happy anniversary. Wait, don't have Alan here for the anniversary. Shit.
Alan, we'll lift a toast to you in your honor. We love you, brother, and hope that the job isn't kicking your ass. And yeah, man, congratulations to 1 year.
Congratulations. One thing I'd like to add really quickly is that you had expressed that talking on this show feels like you're talking to a wall. And that it's all just bricks in the wall. And so if you feel like you're talking to the wall, aren't we all?
I really wasn't prepared to say anything, but I'm very honored to be a part of tonight. And this room is so filled with love. And I brought a gift of love. I brought a gift that is love. Happy anniversary.
Thank you. Oh, wow, dolphins. That's great.
Dolphins? It's ecstasy.
Wow. Thanks, guy. That's an amazing present. A sweetheart you are.
What a sweetheart. It's late.
Sleepy baby.